formula that is actually sort of near and dear to my heart, because when I was a kid, it was actually one of the things that got me interested in physics in the first place. So when I was in grade 6, it was about 11, and I was at my brother's hockey game, and I asked my dad, I said, "Dad, what does E equals MC squared mean?" So he gave me some weird answer. He didn't really know. My dad's an engineer, but he doesn't, not a physicist, so he said something like, "Well, it means energy equals mass times the square of the speed of light." And I said, "Okay, what does that mean?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. It's kind of like when you're traveling fast, clocks go slower." I said, "Oh, why?" He's like, "I don't know." It's like, "But we measured it. We've done, there's like, people have done these measurements." I'm like, "Really? Wow. It's really interesting." But I felt really unsatisfied. And this was a shock to me, because before this point, my dad could answer all of the questions that I had, right? And this one, I was just really not happy with his answer. So then I started asking more people, asked my teacher. They didn't really know either. And then I asked other older people, and no one seemed to really be able to tell me a good answer. And I got really frustrated because of this. And so finally I just said, "Screw it, I'll just try to look it up on my own." Which is really hard, because I was like 11, right? So I was like trying to read these textbooks and had all these complicated explanations. But so I tried, and I got interested in physics that way. That's how I started reading about physics. But I don't think I ever got a good answer to the question that I had. I was 12 years old until about maybe third year university. Because it's weird, like even in first year, people try to derive it, or they show at least that it's plausible, but they don't really, I didn't really buy it, you know? And so I hope that today I can give you a better explanation than what I have. Okay, Damien took his little page. I was gonna put the page up because I thought it was interesting. The one thing that you don't see on that page, you see quantum gravity and general relativity, all these really cool things. Sure. Well, whatever, it's okay. But the one thing you don't see is Newton's laws and Maxwell's equations. And those things are like really boring, right? But they're also really important too. So since most of you guys are in grade 11, right? Or you just, so probably a lot of you haven't even taken high school physics, or have you? A little bit, right? Okay. So I'm going to do a little bit of a review just to remind you. And then I have to tell you one thing about Maxwell's equations so you can understand where I'm going with this. Okay. So that's the first thing that I want to do is just do a little bit of E&M with you guys. So this is pretty old physics. Maybe like 150 years old. And it's just electricity and magnetism, right? So if you have a proton, charged particle, just sitting at like a point in space, the origin, it'll have a Coulomb field. So in your physics classes, have you learned about that? Yeah. Some of you maybe, but maybe probably not all of you. So okay, that's good. Now this is what happens. I mean, the closer you get to the proton, the bigger the electric field that you feel is, if you're like a little press charge or something. So this is what it looks like. It goes as 1/r² and it just sort of looks like this. It doesn't really matter about, don't worry about the 1/r, but the point is that the further you get away, the greater the electric field. It kind of looks like this. All right. Now, here's the thing. So imagine I just take this another proton and I sort of bring it in all the way from infinity. As I bring the two protons closer together, there's going to be more of an electric force, right? And they don't want to be together because they're the same charge. So I have to do work to push them together. And the question is, where does the work go? I mean, probably most of you are familiar with conservation of energy, right? And so you could think of it a few different ways. You could think of it as going into potential energy. But another way to think of it, okay, so now what I've done is I've taken this in and I brought them together. Maybe they're so close now that they've bonded to form like a nuclei of a helium atom. And now the field changes because you have two protons instead of one. going to have more charge, more electric field. But there's still going to be one over R dependent. So now the electric field is kind of going to look like this, right? This is what it looked like before. This is what it looks like now. And you can see it's sort of like gotten bigger. The idea is that the energy that you put into pushing them together gets stored into the electric field. So it's just sort of like, kind of like the area of this. But it's not exactly the area. It's actually like the square of it. All right? So you can do all the calculations. And probably in university, you will do these calculations and see exactly how it works. But the end result is that the total energy stored in the field, just the square of the field times a half.
There is a constant, or?
Sure, there's constants. Actually, this may not look, if you've seen this before, it may not look totally familiar to you, but that's because I'm using Gaussian units, so I'm using a different unit system. Okay? So here is this one then. Okay. Now, you can do the same thing with the magnetic field. We call it B. It's not really all that important. And you get the same result. So if you have an electromagnetic field, the energy density, the energy stored in the fields, is just given by this formula. Okay? That's the only thing that's important. You guys believe that or remember it. All right, now I have this really complicated looking thing. I guess it's not that complicated looking if you guys have been doing quantum mechanics, but this is just a wave of light. Okay? So for a really long time, people thought that light was just that. It was just a wave. And you can still think of it that way most of the time. All right? So we have this wave, and it kind of looks like this. You've never seen a picture like this before. This is the electric field direction, and this is the magnetic field direction. And this is like space going this way. So just sort of picture this field going up and down in time, then moving along. Okay. This is what it looks like. You have an electric field that goes in one direction and a magnetic field that comes out in the other direction. They just sort of loop around each other like this. All right. So that's just a little picture of what light is. And what happens is when this electron feels that these changing electrical magnetic fields, it feels a force, right? And that force sort of makes it do this thing. Now, the reason why I drew this picture is just sort of to give you a basic idea. If you buy this, if you buy that this happens, then you'll believe that this light is actually giving this particle some momentum. It's kind of like in the Compton effect. Probably you guys didn't do that. But it's kind of like the photon's coming in, the light's coming in, it's hitting this electron, and it's pushing it a little bit. Okay? But in order to give it a momentum, it has to have some of its own momentum. That's the only point I've drawn the picture is to show you that this light has momentum. And the momentum is given by this equation. All right? Now, if you notice, this thing on the top, a half e squared plus b squared, was the same formula that I had for the energy. Okay. So you could just write this as the energy over c. All right. This formula is saying that light is a wave like this. It carries some energy, and it carries some momentum in this direction. Okay. And the relationship between the energy and the momentum is given by this. All right. So I'm going to just write down all of our results on the side. This is the first one. Okay. Results. So let's remember that. So this is probably going to be the conceptually the most difficult part of the entire talk. Let's just And also, it's like the most hand-waving part too. Because I can't derive all this stuff from first principles. You have to sort of believe me. Right? Okay. Now I want to turn this thing off. Help. Oh, this thing is off. Sorry. Okay, so if you guys have any questions, oh good, yeah. Sorry, I changed, yeah, I called it like W, because it was like, yeah, and, yeah, I called it Q actually, yeah, you're right. Sorry, I changed notation. E is now energy, okay? And the reason is because it looks way cooler when E equals mg squared, not U. Yeah, okay. All right, sorry, yeah, good point. Yeah, so that's good. If anyone has any questions, then I'm going to probably screw up, all right, because I'm not used to chalkboard stuff. Let me know and ask any questions that you have. All right, so I want to start. I need to sort of remind you of some results from Newton's laws, okay? So if you bear with me just for a little bit. I'll get to the interesting stuff after. All right. So conservation of momentum. Who here is familiar with conservation of momentum? A few of you? Yeah, almost all of you. So you know, you believe me if I say momentum is conserved. Okay. All right, so I don't really need to do this. But I'm going to because it's kind of neat just to show my quick derivation of conservation momentum. If you have a particle, if you have some little ball of mass, call it m1, and then some velocity, and then you have another guy coming in here, call it m2, velocity 2, and then they collide. And when they collide, they sort of deform, okay? Yeah, they're not like point balls, they're just real balls. And when they do this, this is when they're changing their velocities and stuff. So the balls come in during the part where they're in contact, they're pushing against each other, and then they're going to fly apart. So afterwards, they're going to have, okay, so this is maybe the initial velocity. Now they have some final velocity. And the same thing with this guy. Right. So we've maybe seen this happen if you play pool or something. So we're totally familiar with this. Okay. So the question is, what happens right in the middle here? And why don't I just define momentum as mass times velocity. So it'll be the mass of this thing times the magnitude of this velocity. Okay? That's really easy. So what happens if I look at the total momentum of this system before, or rather during the collision? Okay? So during the collision we have, or maybe it's actually just right as they meet. Okay, so far they still have, you know, V1 and V2. That hasn't changed. So they're just sort of touching, right? So it's just M1, V1, plus M2, V2. Now I'm going to take the time derivative. You guys familiar with this? We're just asking how quickly this is changing in time. We'll assume the masses are not changing in time, but maybe the velocities will. Okay. So, what's the time derivative of the velocity?
Acceleration.
Okay, really easy. M1, A1, plus M2. So You guys recognize this?
Force.
It's a force, right? F1 plus that, F1 plus that. Easy, right? So we use Newton's first law, a second law, or yeah, second law here. Now we can do one more thing. We can use Newton's third law, right? So this is the force that this guy feels. This is the force the other guy feels. So what's Newton's third law? You guys remember? You guys know?
Every action is equal and opposite reaction.
Equal and opposite, right? So in equations, what does that mean?
That both forces will be the same.
The same?
Opposite.
But opposite. F1 equals negative F2. And if that's true, then this is zero. Okay? So I just showed that the total momentum doesn't change in time using Newton's laws. Okay? So that's conservation of momentum. That's why it's true. I mean, I guess it's why it's true. If you believe that Newton's laws are right, you have to believe that momentum is conserved during this collision. Alright? Have you guys seen that before? No? Well, you've probably heard of that before. Maybe you haven't seen it derived this way.
No one's ever shown it to us.
Sure. Cool. Calculus is cool. Alright. And or another way of writing this is just that the momentum at the beginning is the same as momentum at the end. Question? Yeah? Okay. So that's our second result here. All right. The next thing that I need to derive for you that you may not, that you guys might, I don't think you see this in high school, is that, well, some of you might, the center of mass. So I'm just going to define the center of mass. And that's the center of mass of this thing, the system here. So x1 is like the position of this particle, particle 1. x2 is the position of particle 2. And then so you take the average and you weight the average by the mass and you divide by the total mass. That's the center of mass. Okay. So why did I write this down this way? And the reason why I wrote it down is because this is something that also has interesting properties in time. And we can see that by doing the same thing we did before. We'll take time derivatives. So this actually is the total momentum, right? We just have here. Actually, yeah, it's probably best if we just write it that way. But we just showed that this is constant time. So why don't we take another time derivative? Because this is zero, this whole thing is zero. What it means is that the acceleration, the center of mass, does not accelerate, okay, during the collision. Center of mass has the same as zero acceleration, the same velocity. Okay. Another way of saying that is that if we're in a frame where the center of mass is not moving, the velocity of the center of mass is zero. At the end of the collision, the velocity of the center of mass is also going to be zero. Okay? That's all it means. So that's what I'm going to write down. Initially is equal to the velocity of the center of mass. Final, And if this is zero, that's zero. Okay? So does everyone buy that?
Yeah.
Or
okay. But I need to use these results in order to derive E equals MC squared. Okay? This is actually all that I need. A lot of people say, or they hear that you really need to know relativity to be able to understand E equals MC squared. And that's actually not true. I'm not even going to talk about relativity. Well, I will, but only at the very, very end and only very, very subtle thing. But you don't really need relativity, and that's kind of interesting. And I'll show you how, okay? So now we're getting to the fun stuff, hopefully. Derivation. We're going to do a thought experiment. Okay. Einstein loved these things. This is a pretty simple one, though. Just a box in space. Right? So imagine the entire universe is just a box. It just has a box. And everything else is empty. Alright? That's all that's happening. Now, inside this box, there's a little light. Like a light bulb or something, or like a laser or something. And, okay, so there's a light on this side of the box. And then it shoots out a little thing of light. Okay, what's going to happen?
The box will project its mantle.
Yeah, why?
The box will attack. The light also has momentum.
Yeah.
The center of the total momentum has to be.
Exactly, right. Right, correct. So the light carries momentum. That's what I showed. Well, that's the first equation that we wrote down. It's the first result. Light has some momentum. So when the light is produced, this box is going to recoil. So if the light goes this way, the box is going to go that way. And that's because of conservation of momentum. It's the second result we have. Now, imagine this light keeps going, and then it hits the other side of the box. What's going to happen?
The box will
slow down. Exactly. It'll slow down, but like it'll lose all the momentum it has, so it'll stop. So you have this picture in your mind: the light goes, boom, the box moves, the light hits it, and it stops. So in the beginning it was here, in the end it's here. Okay. Now, what about our third result? That the velocity of the center of mass is going to be the same. So, initially, what is the velocity? Okay, so initially, the box, what's the center of mass of the box? Say it's symmetric. It's right in the middle of the box, right? So, it's not moving. The box is not moving. You just said that. So, the initial velocity of the center of mass is zero. And the final velocity is zero. Okay, that's true. And actually, it's supposed to be zero all the way through. So, so what's the position of the center of box, the center of mass of the box at the end? It's moved, right? So, if it was zero the whole time, then how did it move from one spot to the other? That's a good question. All right. So let's see if we can solve that. It's not that bad. Okay, so here we have our box. And I'm going to call it M, mass capital M. Okay. So this box has a length, 2L. So the whole thing is 2L. So I'm going to write L here, and minus L here. It's a nice way to do it because it's symmetric. So this is what happens initially. And what we wrote down was that the velocity of the box is zero initially. And also we wrote down, or we said, that the center of mass of the box is zero. So what's the momentum? Zero. Right. Okay. I'm gonna need this definition, so I'm gonna write it down there too. Now, in the midway point. Oh, right. Sorry, I forgot to show this. There's a little flash of light starting here, but so far it hasn't done anything. Of course, the midway point, now we have L minus L, but the box has started to move. Okay, so it's moving, and we have a little thing of light now, or light, that is moving now in the box, and it has momentum, P. We can call it anything we want, we'll just call it P, alright? So, this is the velocity of the box, right? Right. So if the momentum started off at zero, what's the momentum now?
Zero.
Right. So P total is zero. And how many types of momentum do we have? We have the momentum of the box, and then we have the momentum of the light. Okay. Equals zero. Well, we call this P. All right. So P of the box. Plus P equals zero. So P of the box is just negative P. And actually, I'm only really worried about the absolute value of the momentum. And that's just going to be P. So, if we want to know the, what's the velocity of the box then? That's the question. Does anyone know? P over M. P over M. Okay. So it's moving with that velocity in this direction. Okay? What about the center of mass? Well, I'm just going to put a question mark here.
Oh, well, not large.
Yeah, what about the light? Has no, light doesn't have mass.
The center of mass?
Sorry?
Center of mass?
Yeah, it's a question mark. We'll just leave the question mark.
The center of mass must be the same because nothing has changed.
Exactly.
But the box has moved and there is all the mass on the box.
Right. Something confusing is happening. Okay, so let's try to find a way to solve this conceptually. Although this image is going to be a bit fuzzy even at the end of this talk. But we'll see. There'll be a big revelation in a second. In the final configuration, what do we have? So, all right. Draw this. L minus L. So the box has moved now. And now what's happened is the box has reabsorbed the light. So now it's stopped moving. It's not moving anymore. Okay? And it's moved a distance. We'll call it B. Okay? We'll call that this distance d. And we can actually calculate it, all right? And we can calculate it because we know how fast the box is moving when it was moving. And we know how long it takes for light to get from one side of the box to the other. Okay? We'll actually just say, you'll find out tomorrow that that light travels at the same velocity in every frame. So we can just sort of like pretend that we're just in the box, and we'll see the light travel the speed of light. All right? So if it does, the time it takes for the light to get from one side of the box to the other is just, what is it? It's 2L, 2 times L over C. C is the speed of light. So the box is 2L, and it takes it, wait. So we're pretty familiar with this, it's just like V equals D over T, and you rearrange it. Any questions? No? All right. And so this distance, D equals the velocity that this box had when it was moving times the time that it was moving. All right, so V box midway times T. We have the formula P over M times 2L over C. Or just 2 P over C times L over M. I'll just write it that way. And this is our fifth result. So how do we solve the problem? What's happening with the center of mass? Position of the center of mass. Sorry?
Should it be moving?
Should it be moving, but it does. And so what we postulate to solve the problem is that, okay, because yeah, if we just look at the center of mass here at 0, and if we look at the center of mass here, okay, of the box, it's minus d. So that's the confusing thing. Why is it moving? And we can fix the problem by postulating this. This is what Einstein realized. This is what was actually really brilliant about what he thought of, is that you can imagine that before the light was light, it was something else. It was a bead of mass M. It was something that had mass. Okay? So there's a little bead. And now the center of mass is on 0, it's going to be shifted a little bit this way, right? Now in the final step, the light goes, okay, we're still going to leave the question mark. And it gets here. And it turns back into a bead of mass M. And if you buy that, then you'll see that now the center of mass is not minus D, but it's been shifted a little bit more. So the question is, how heavy does this bead have to be to make sure that the center of mass stays the same the whole time? That's the question. All right? So you have to kind of believe that. But does it matter? A bead of mass can turn into light. And light carries energy. That's what people normally say about matter turning into energy. It doesn't really turn into energy. Energy is not this like fluid sort of substance. But what it does turn into is it turns into light. And light carries energy. Right? So we're going to try to find a formula for M. Okay? In terms of the momentum of the light. So you can imagine the more momentum that the light has, the more this box is going to move, the heavier this thing has to be to counterbalance the center of mass. Right? And we make that explicit just by writing down equations. But basically, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for a relationship between the mass of the particle, and the momentum of the light that's produced. Okay? So let's just write it down, and I lost my pages. All right. So we have one formula for D already. And we can now calculate D using the center of mass. Okay? So our formula for the center of mass, I wrote right here. Okay, it's 4. So in this case, all right, the center of mass of the box is just at the origin. So we have the center of mass equals 0 times m. Right? Center of mass of the box is at the origin. Plus minus L times little m divided by big M plus little m. Does everyone see this? Yes? Yeah? Okay. Everyone buys this. Good. This is just 0, so let me just write negative L M over big M plus little m. All right. So this is the new center of mass. This is the old one. This is not what we're thinking anymore. Now we're thinking the way Einstein did. Okay? X center of mass equals this. What about at the end? It's the center of mass. Okay, so it's m1 times x1. So the box has moved, and its middle is at minus d. So it's m times minus d. And now this guy is at a distance l minus d. See that? Okay. Now I'm just going to rearrange. I'm going to rearrange this, okay? Oh, wait. Minus d times big M plus little m. Right? Minus d, big M plus little m. Over big M plus little m. Questions?
You sure? Questions. What did you say these three formulas represent again?
Pardon?
What did you say these three formulas represent again?
Which formulas?
These three. XCM.
The center of mass? Yeah. So this is the center of mass of the system.
Okay.
Right? Just like when we did it with the particles at the beginning. We had two particles, and that makes our system. And what I showed is that the center mass of the system is constant, is not changing. If the velocity is zero initially, it's not changing in time. Okay? So the center of mass has to be the same.
Okay.
That's what those formulas are. So I'm calculating the center of mass at the beginning, and then I'm calculating it at the end. And then I'm going to put them equal together. I'm going to find a formula for D. That's what I'm doing.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Okay. So this minus L times little m over big M little m. These terms lock out. We're left with minus D. This is a plus, so plus. Okay?
Plus.
Where?
The L is positive.
Yeah. L is positive, so yes. Plus. What did I do?
There.
Is this good?
Yes.
Okay, beautiful. Good. And like I said, this thing has to be equal to this thing. That's Newton's law to tell us that. So I can just set them equal. Minus Lm over m plus m equals minus d plus L little m over m plus m. I'm just going to bring the d on this side and this guy on this side. D equals 2L m over big M plus little m. So this is what the d is in terms of the mass of the particle. And now we have this result, right? This is what we found before, that the distance had to be based on the velocity of this box, okay? So we can put 5 equal to this guy. So is this math losing people? It's just math. I'm just manipulating equations right now. Okay, and the physics will pop out at the end. So if you can't see the math, like the physics in every single step of these equations, it's okay, it'll come in time. But, pardon?
You think it means centimeters.
Okay.
No, I don't think that. Oh. I just keep reading it.
Okay, sorry. Here, I'll write it differently. 2 P over C times L over M. This is way better anyways. I like this. I like it better this way. Okay, so now we can actually eliminate D. We're eliminating D from this equation. And what we want is P and M. We want M on one side and P on the other side. So I'm just going to do a little bit of math. The 2's knock out. So, let's see. PC. The L's also knock out. Times. Okay. How about I multiply each side by m, and also each side by m plus m. What I'm going to be left with is this guy's going to cancel. So I'm going to have m big M equals p over c m plus m. Okay. Again, I want the m's on this side, the p's on that side, the little m's. So it's just m times big M minus p over c equals p over c times big M. And then I can divide. We're almost there. Because now I have m and p's. This is exactly what I want. I'm just going to write this in a different form and divide the top and the bottom by m. It's going to leave me with p over c times 1 over 1 minus p over c m. This is what I want. M equals that. Okay? So that was the most mathematical part of the derivation. And we're pretty much done. Alright? We're pretty much done. So now we're doing physics. Okay. I need to do one more thing. And this is where I'm going to finally talk a little bit about relativity. All right. What do you guys know about relativity? Anything? Yeah, sure. That, because what is the simplest thing? Time dilation. What, where are these effects important?
Effects of relativity.
At high speeds.
At high speeds. Or what? V is close to the speed of light?
Yeah.
Okay. So right now, I'm doing Newton's laws, right? And we don't, none of us believe that Newton's laws are valid when V is close to C, right? Because we heard about relativity. So basically, that's true here too, is that we need to talk about velocities lower than the speed of light. Otherwise, my formula is not going to work. All right? And what that means is that the velocity of the box is much smaller than the speed of light. Or V of the box over C is much smaller than 1. And we have V of the box somewhere. It's just P over M, C, much smaller than 1. Recognize this? It's right here. Okay. So when I say that the velocity of the box is much smaller than 1, what I really mean is that this thing is much smaller than 1. And if I take 1 and I subtract a number a lot smaller than 1, what do I get?
Almost
something very close to 1. So this thing is almost equal to P over C. Almost. Now we're really, really close. Does anyone see the next step? So I have M approximately equal to P over C. Anyone see what to do next?
Yes.
Uh-huh, right. But, number one, E, P equals E over C. B over C squared. And if we bring the C to this side, P equals MC squared. Yay! Okay, that's our, I said that's our sixth result. Okay. All right. That's it. Right. So what does that mean? What it means is that we had this little bead of mass M, and we found that E, that when the mass turns into light, when the bead of matter turns into light, it produces light that has an energy that's equal to mc squared. And that's so that conservation of energy and conservation of center mass have to be valid. Okay? So we've had these like these principles of conservation of energy, and we've imposed them on this box system, and we found this formula. Okay? So now hopefully you have an idea of where that comes from. Right? I can give you an example. So where do we know that energy actually Do you believe it? Do you buy this explanation that the speed is turning into light? Does anyone have examples of where matter can be turned into light? Energy.
The light that carries energy.
Yeah.
Nuclear fission.
Perfect. That's a good example. It's a good example because it's not totally right. But it is right. It's not totally right. Because people say that. They say that all the time. Oh yeah, in fusion you have mass being converted to energy. But actually, it's in fusion, you have like an atom, a nucleus of like uranium. No. In fission, you have uranium, and then you have little electrons buzzing around. Okay, but the nucleus itself has some binding energy. Okay, and so some people will say that, okay, when you have fusion, it's not actually matter being converted, it's the binding energy being turned into, being released into other energy. But because we have this equation, we can think of it as the same thing. So sometimes people call the binding energy of something part of its mass. But you can do that because we have this equation. It's a good example, it's one that people use, but it's kind of like loose terminology. But what's a really pure example? Yeah.
Matter energy.
Right, that's the purest example you can think of. Is if you have an electron coming in and a positron coming in. And they produce
photon.
Right. They come in and they produce a gamma ray. So what happens is when this matter and antimatter come together, they actually produce, they disappear from the universe and they produce a thing of light. And that's exactly what's, you know, hopefully happening here. We have maybe some sort of annihilation happening. So yeah, so these are like beads, and this is our pulse of light. Okay? So that's what's happening. Does anyone have any questions? Yeah. Yeah.
You said when matter and antimatter collide, they destroy each other completely, right?
Yeah.
So how come we're all still here?
Well, because luckily there's, well, we don't really know, right? But for some reason, maybe the universe is not created with an equal amount of matter and an equal amount of antimatter. And so the matter, like, won out, maybe.
Why?
Maybe that's a reason. We actually have absolutely no idea. It could also be that maybe there is antimatter somewhere, like a matter zone and an antimatter zone, and they never really interact all that much. That would be really confusing, though, because you think that like at the interface there'd be a huge amount of energy. But we don't know, really know the answer to that question, why there's more matter than antimatter. We have theories, and they're really interesting theories, but they haven't been proven yet. Yeah.
So when you have an electron and a positron, and they kind of cancel out, then why do you still end up with a gamma ray? Why would it just be nothing?
Nothing?
Yeah.
So for one main reason, it's so that you have conservation of energy, right? And exactly for this reason, right? Because think of it, this is an electron coming in, and a positron. And so in order for this whole thing to work, in order, if you believe conservation of momentum and energy, you believe like Newton's laws, then you need that. You need to have something else. And this gamma carries the energy that these guys had initially.
Oh, so the mass disappears with energy.
Yeah. It doesn't like disappear and turn into energy. The mass turns into light, and the light carries energy.
Yeah.
Right? So the reason why I say that is because now this little gamma ray can go, and like this little gamma ray is this thing of light, and it can go and it can move electrons, it can go shake them and move them. That's what I mean by energy. So like if you have an atom bomb, you have all these like light rays coming out, and they're pushing things, and that is what causes all the destruction, right? They're coming in with huge momentum, they're smacking into things, and they're destroying like atoms and chemicals and your body and the planet. Yeah.
Can you get a positron and electron from the gamma ray?
Pardon?
Can you get a positron?
Yes. Yes, you can. You can turn, and that's what happens here, right? The gamma rays come in, and then it's like fired off a positron and electron.
But doesn't the mass disappear?
Pardon?
The mass disappear.
The what thing disappears?
The mass gamma rays.
So that's the whole thing, is that energy can be converted into mass through this equation. But that's what happens, is that now the photon has no mass.
Is the total mass in the electron and positron zero?
No. No, no. The mass of an electron is the same as the mass of the positron. They both have positive mass, right? We don't really understand what it means to have negative mass. If it did, then things would like anti-gravitate. Right? You'd have like, I don't know, like massive bodies that could push each other away. So we believe that all particles have positive mass.
So what's the difference between electron and positron?
They have the opposite charge. Right. So they have the same mass. Pardon?
So, okay. I understand that they have opposite charge, but
yeah.
So then why is it that their opposite charge is causing masses?
It's a very good question. It's also a very complicated question because, so I've seen the answer to that question. Like, and
so what is out there?
No, it's out there. And it's just like, but it's weird though because it doesn't mean anything physically to me. So that's why it's hard for me to explain it.
Yeah.
It comes out of these like quantum field theory calculations. And you just sort of like, or considerations that Dirac had about representations of the Lorentz group. So it's all, it's actually, it kind of comes out of relativity. But it doesn't mean anything to me physically, so it's very hard to give an explanation. It just sort of is that way. And the bottom line is that we measure that. We have particle accelerators, we can produce these things, and this is what we see.
Okay.
Yeah.
When in the vacuum, an electron and a positron create and then destroy.
Yeah.
This mass.
Yeah, what's that mass? So so this is what you're talking about. You're talking about, like, inside the vacuum, you can have, according to quantum field theory, you can have these things. They're called quantum fluctuations. And you have electrons and positrons being created and then annihilating. And it kind of looks like this. An electron and a positron. And the weird thing is that if you turn this arrow in another direction, it looks like you have an electron going backwards and forwards in time continually. Right? And so you can think of it, that's a good way to think of it. Where's the mass going? Well, this thing is just going backwards and forwards in time. But also, the real thing is that this is not, these are not real particles. They're virtual particles. So they're not on mass shell. So they're not, which means that they don't have, like, energy and mass the same way that normal particles do. That's really confusing, I know. The other thing is that, like, this energy doesn't gravitate like normal energy. And that's really confusing. This is the cosmological constant problem, right? You guys have heard about the dark energy. We predict huge, like an infinite value for this, right? Because these things are happening at every point in space all the time. And so if this energy that these guys had gravitates, or if there was energy, that would be an infinite contribution, right? So we believe that it's there, but we do this thing where we just subtract it away. And that's called renormalization, right? So the answer is that we sort of sweep it under the rug. We say, well, we don't observe a huge gravitational field from these guys. So we'll say that there's some other force that exactly cancels it, basically, is what we do. And it works. It works really well.
Of course it works.
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice. But the other thing is that you can't measure these things directly. So, yeah. Well, you can measure these things indirectly, which is interesting, which is why we know that they're there. Otherwise, we'd get rid of them completely, right? It's weird, yeah. Any other questions? These are good questions. Any other questions about the derivation? Yeah.
It's that light is some kind of mass before it turns into light, right?
Yeah.
So do we know? First of all, do we know why that is, and like why does it turn from mass into light? Because we just say, in order to have all our equations right, in order to explain that experiment, let's say that we have to say that some kind of like mass turns into light somehow. Like why does it do that? Do you know how it is?
It's a really good question, and I think that this is how we interpret it, and this is the sort of like the easiest way that we know how to interpret what's happening. It's not a very good answer to the question, but ultimately that's true, is that we believe in conservation of energy because we like to build our space and our time in a certain way, and that's an easy way to do it. So we understand. So we have a model that we can use to explain the world. And it works. If you have, you know, that's the thing, is that if there's a better one out there, then we need to find it. And maybe there is, right? And that's what physics is all about. I mean, it's about questioning these methods. This is how we interpret our experiments. Okay? Yeah.
Like, from there, the result one.
Yeah.
You have momentum equals energy divided by the speed of light.
Yeah.
Can you just write momentum in the...
Right.
Yeah.
You could say, and some people do this, that it's like, oh, look, put derivation equals mc squared. P, the momentum of the light is just... oh, wait. the mass of the B times C, right? And then they say that is equal to E over C, therefore M E equals M C squared, right? That's what you're saying.
What's the problem?
So why don't I do all that stuff?
Well, because you're avoiding expressing the momentum in terms of M, right?
Yeah.
But ultimately, you're getting a mass out of the line.
Yeah. 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 But it's not. I'm not actually getting. Because if this were true, then there wouldn't be this term in the formula. So it's not exact. We're not really cheating that much, right? But it's because you can't think of mass like light as having a mass. Light doesn't have mass, right? So sometimes people say, oh, this is like the effective mass of the light. But there's no such thing, right? Mass, light does not have mass. And if you just did this blindly, you would get the wrong result here. Although, so the other thing, the other issue that I didn't really talk about is that this is only true in the non-relativistic limit where the velocities are slow. Right, and really to do this properly, you need to do full relativity, the Lorentz transformations, and all this stuff. And you guys are going to learn about that tomorrow, I think. David's going to talk about it. Okay, but to make the math easier, you can just sort of look at it in these like non-relativistic frames. So you go
this. Well, that's something without a mass carrying momentum.
Ah, well, that's the result of Maxwell's equations and like the light we studied. So you bought that when I put it up on here. I didn't derive these for first principles, but you can. And so everyone at Einstein's, everyone believed that this was true. But no one made this connection. Actually, some people did. Believe it or not, Einstein was the first person to think of this. Yeah.
So the reason that that's not true.
Yeah. Because if we go into larger speeds, we can't use these Newtonian ideas of time and space. We have to use relativity. But it just so happens that in this limit, relativity and Newtonian mechanics are the same thing. So that's why it gives us the relativistic result. Okay, right. But yeah, you can't think of this as having effective mass. It's the wrong thing. Okay. Yeah.
I've read in a book that actually, I don't remember his name, but someone found out that actually Einstein, like the equation actually has to be E equals plus minus mc squared.
Oh, right.
I just want to know, like, how is that possible? And, like, moreover, what does it mean? Like, why do you have plus minus?
So this was a really interesting thing because this led to quantum field theory. Because when you do the full relativistic version, okay, which I haven't done, but you find something like E squared equals M squared C to the fourth plus P squared C squared. So now this is like the momentum of some object, right? This is the full formula. But there's little square roots, and so you could ask the question, well, if you do the square root, okay, it gets rid of this thing. Well, what happens to the plus or minus from the square root? There are positive solutions and negative energy solutions to this equation. It's kind of like semantics, right? But this is related to the question of matter and antimatter. Very, very loosely speaking, the plus is like matter and the minus is like antimatter. But that's very loosely speaking. In the end, people were led to solve the problem that way. And if you know the Schrodinger equation, is based on this. Did you guys study this when you looked at quantum mechanics? Operators like E goes to minus thi by t h bar something. P is like minus I. I don't remember. How about ix? So if you put these things into here, so when you're doing relativistic quantum mechanics, there's this ambiguity. And it turns out the solution is to think of these in terms of matrix equations. So that's, you get the Dirac equation out of it. and then you have all these, and that's where you predict particles and antiparticles. So Dirac predicted antiparticles existing before we even measured, knew that neutrons existed. And eventually we found these things. So it's a long story, and I don't really have time to get into the detail. But I would definitely keep thinking about it. So there's a lot of really interesting physics that comes out of this. But you have to, it takes years to learn all of it.
Right? So,
but don't worry. I mean, don't be intimidated. It's really interesting, and every step is interesting. Yeah. How do we measure them?
Very carefully. Very careful.
Yeah, very carefully. Well, we measure their what they do, right? Pardon? Well, we of course have to assume a model, which is this. We have to assume this is right, and then we interpret our experiments based on that. So yeah, you're right. It's a good point. How do we measure it? So maybe, maybe the gamma comes in and produces an electron and a positron, and then this positron will hit another electron, and then it'll produce gamma rays, right? And we can predict that. We can predict the spectrum for that, how this will happen. And so then we go and we measure with our particle accelerators, and we see traces. So we see the gamma rays coming out, and we know that if they're just the right energy, that we'll see that we can...
That positron and that electron has a big other right?
Okay. And now... Yeah. So now it's hitting another electron, and now there's a gamma ray.
So you're getting a gamma ray with a gamma ray?
Yeah.
So what is it?
Pardon? Yeah. It's true. So so this gamma ray might have come from other like particles hitting, and you can predict it. You can predict how these gamma rays are going to come out. And the other thing that's really like, the thing is that this actually produces, well, you might be able to see this, but it produces two gamma rays, really. And then the two gamma rays shoot off like this, so the momentum is conserved, right? The momentum of the whole thing has to be zero. So it shoots out to, and they have to be of the right energy, right? Z equals mc squared. So if we see two gamma rays come in like this, and they have the right energy, then we think it came from annihilation of electron positron. So that's how we can recognize the traces of these things experimentally. Yes?
From this formula, doesn't it mean that the positron has negative energy?
Negative energy, yeah.
So when they collapse,
yeah. This is a long, so I said very loosely speaking. You know, and then you could say, yeah. Is the Hamiltonian not found in the flow? Dirac had this huge picture of like a negative energy sea. So a sea of negative energy particles. And an antiparticle is a hole in that sea. So it just pops out of the vacuum, and then there's a particle that's full, and the hole moves. That was his picture. Yeah. It's not what we believe now. Okay, I think we're almost done. So this is probably the last question.
So at the most basic levels, all light created from a positron.
Like I said before, you can have the binding energy of something, and you can interpret that as mass through this relationship. So, like, if you have, like, a chemical goes from one state to another state, the binding energy changes.
Yeah.
And the difference in the energy is the energy of the particle release, of the light particle release. So not all particles are produced, not all light is produced this way. But because we have this picture, people will often say that, when the energy levels change, the total mass of the chemical or the nucleus changes. And we say that mass has been converted to energy. But these are just pictures, they're just names we give things. Okay.
So, just a very short question. So are the particles predicted by E equals mc squared and Schrodinger's equation?
In Schrodinger's relativistic equation, yes. In the non-relative discipline, no.
Okay, so we'll have a break in a second, guys. But first of all, if you've gone around the course, we'll talk about it.